Welcome to another episode of Open Science Radio, this time the number 98. And as you can hear, today we do this in English. And today we have a guest. Besides me, as usual, Matthias is with me. Hi, Matthias.
Good morning.
And our special guest this time is Björn Brems. Hi, Björn.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Björn, this was we needed quite some attempts to come together, but finally we made it. And we're really pleased to have you around here, because you are, well, one of the driving forces, in my opinion, in this field, pushing in a certain direction, which we will discuss in a second. I would say we start with a little bit of your background before we really actually touch that topic. So maybe you can explain a little bit what you're doing right now, and what is your position, and what is your aim there?
Well, the lucky thing, or depending on your personality, the lucky thing is that I'm still doing the same thing that I did as a diploma student, which is sort of like a master's student, when was that? 1994-5, something like that, which is essentially creating digital data and then evaluating them. And the model system that I use is Drosophila, and we have more or less automated behavioral recordings, behavioral experiments. And so I have digitally recorded behavioral data that have the same structure, which indeed I'm using the same measurement device since then. And they have the exact same structure. And so I've been waiting since the mid-1990s for an infrastructure that takes care of that data. Of course, at the time, the internet was fairly new. In 1995, I've had an email address for like 2 years or something like this. At the time, the idea wasn't really there that one could do something with the data. We did discuss, of course, that nobody can really see the data because nobody has the tools to evaluate the data. It's just, you know, bits and pieces. And so at the time, this wasn't really much of a concern. But looking back now, essentially, it's quite frustrating that a lot of journals are demanding, and I want to share data. There are more and more people using digital behavioral tools, and it's very cumbersome to share data when essentially it would be so very easy to just collect the data, have the data out there automatically, and not have to worry about if a reviewer, a colleague, or a journal asks, hey, where's the data for it? I can just tell them, well, look, there it is, without having to do anything myself. And so essentially that's one of several drivers that motivate me to push for institutions implementing that sort of infrastructure such that I don't have to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. And currently you are a professor at the University of Regensburg. So you are, well, you have, as you said, you have quite a time and research behind you, and you basically still waiting for this. So basically more than 20 years, if you want it like this. And it's kind of amazing that we are not yet there. And you're also pushing, I mean, this is basically the data that you want to have, but you're also pushing kind of in the direction that also the journals should be implemented in a different way as they are right now. You wrote several blog posts in this direction, and one was, for example, written last year in November, and this was kind of the initial point where we said, okay, we really need to discuss this finally with you. And you also could show that, well, there are different flaws in our system that, let's say, certain journals might have a certain reputation that they might not necessarily deserve. Let's maybe start with some basic steps here. So in principle, you often argue that that we pay quite a high price for publishing papers, our basic manuscripts and so on. And we do not necessarily get what we pay for. Maybe we can elaborate this a little bit. So what is your general vision, or what is your general picture on this topic?
Well, so if we want to see what kind of system are we paying for and what are we getting for the money we pay? And in general, there's a consensus number, a ballpark figure, if you will, for the revenue that academic publishers make. Most of that, almost all of it, essentially is due to subscription revenue, subscription income, and that ballpark figure is about $10 billion worldwide every year. So that's what we pay for our scholarly literature. Given that we publish, again, another ballpark figure, about 2 million articles every year, that means that to get these 2 million articles circulated, we pay $10 billion, which means about $5,000 per article. So every subscription article that you have ever read costs the taxpayer $5,000 on average. You know, that means that some will have been just a few dollars, others will have been tens and several tens of thousands of dollars. But on average, it's about $5,000. This is quite shocking, given that the overwhelming majority of those 2 million articles will never be printed and have never been printed, but are available online. And anyone who has ever posted anything online, be that a comment or a blog post or a tweet, notices that, well, if I hit publish on my comment, my tweet or my post, it doesn't cost me anything. I have sort of, you know, background running costs that are either on my blog that I have to pay, like a monthly fee that keeps it running. And then if I post a million blog posts, it costs the same as if I post just one in a year. And if I tweet, then Twitter is taking up the costs and I get advertisements in return or something like that. And so this is quite different. So online publishing appears to be that we have every day appears to be very, very different from the kind of academic publishing. Now you might say that, well, there's a whole lot of other things that are involved, like peer review and things like that. But essentially, that also isn't really an extra cost for anybody because we do the peer review. And so the only extra cost that you would have is somebody organizing the peer review. But then again, in most journals, and I'm an academic editor for PLOS ONE, for instance, and other journals, academics also do the handling of the peer review. So you just need a few staff that keep everything running, that take care of the software, that sort of thing, which isn't really all that different from Facebook or Twitter, and they don't charge anything. So if you look at modern publishing houses, you can find, and this is, they don't need to be very new, like Cielo, Scientific Electronic Library Online, which is a Latin American organization that now has members across the world, that was founded with the help of the NIH. They publish an article at, you know, less than $100 if you just look at the bare bone publishing enterprise. And then you can buy additional services, so the cost can go up to $600 per article if you want to have English language checking and editing or similar services. But those $600 are still a far cry from the $5,000 that we pay. And then there's European or companies such as Scholastica, Science Open, and others, F1000 Research. They also publish in the low hundreds per article. So clearly, there's a discrepancy here that the legacy publishers that we've used in some cases for more than 100 years, that they charge about 10 times of what modern publishers that mainly use the internet. What modern publishers charge and have only used the internet, in principle, the legacy publishers also use the internet, but in some way, they must be doing it the wrong way because they have to charge or they want to charge a lot more. Interestingly, the profit that these legacy publishers make is only a part of it, because that's only 40%. They don't charge 90% profit. It's 40%, that's still a lot, but it only explains a small percentage of the difference. And if you want to believe the legacy publishers as to why they're so expensive, then the next cost item apparently is, they don't give us any concrete figures, but from their arguments, when they argue why the subscription prices have to be as high as they are, they usually cite that their paywall costs are so huge, which means that there's two main differences between modern open access publishers. So these publishers that I mentioned, they publish the articles freely accessible to everybody, while most legacy publishers publish under subscriptions, which means they have to prevent access. And as many people have reported, preventing access in the internet is very, very difficult because the internet was invented to grant access, not to prevent access. And in concordant with that, the publishers argue that their subscription prices have to be so high, among other things, because their paywall costs are so high. So if you sum up paywall costs and profits, then this is probably most of the difference. Now, nobody wants paywalls. And if there's sufficient competition, then 40% profits also don't happen. So essentially, if we had a functioning publishing market, we would be publishing at 10% of the current cost, which is, you know, at most $1 billion instead of $10 billion. And we would have $9 billion infrastructure money, right? So those $9 billion go towards scholarly communication, if you want, or, you know, scholarly publishing. Those $9 billion, if we were able to keep them, could go into, for instance, serve infrastructure that serves our data, that serves our scientific code, and these sorts of things. But at the moment, we're wasting them on paywalls and profits.
And what do you think is the reason for this? Why are we in this situation?
Well, those are mainly historical reasons, because that's how we did it. That's just simply how we've always done things. And then there is the, until, you know, a few years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, there's always been the problem that the faculty at the institutes, they read, and the librarians, they pay. And so when the librarians say, oh, we don't really have money anymore, faculty says, oh, no, that's impossible. I have to read to do my work. So you have to pay. And so what have libraries done? They've cut other purchasing, such as monographs. And so the subscription budgets have been increasing and increasing to the detriment of all the other acquisitions in the library budgets. Now this has changed. Now, in principle, there are so many different ways of accessing paywalled content that one could actually, libraries could cut subscriptions. And now there aren't really any good reasons anymore, in my opinion, why we still have subscriptions.
And you also kind of oppose golden access, golden open access, right? Because you also see there a rather, let's say, high price for little outcome, right?
So this is a very tricky situation. In a way, we brought this on ourselves. So we, and by we I mean the scholarly community, we brought open access publishing to the market, and this sort of open access, in gold open access publishing, which means that the article becomes available immediately, is in some cases funded by the authors paying publication charges. Now, if that were become, and initially that was an attempt to disrupt the subscription publication business, to just show, well, this kind of thing can work in principle. So that was seen as a good thing. Okay, we make things available. But if you think it through and think what are the consequences if not just a few publishers did this, but everyone did this, then it is clear, or several things become clear. For one, it's clear that publishers know that there are $10 billion in the market. So what they will try to do is they will try to go towards those $10 billion in revenue. And if we cannot freely choose which publishers we want to use or in which journals we want to publish, then there's no real competition either. So essentially what that would mean is that the publishers will still shoot for $5,000 per article. That's what they know that the money is around, only that they will not have any paywall costs anymore. So essentially, they stand to efficiency is the same as in the more modern publishing venues. If their efficiency is the same, then they would essentially stand to double their profits from 40 to 80%. Now, one could argue that this is completely impossible, because if they would charge so much, then we would just simply publish somewhere else. But of course, that's the same reason why we cannot cut subscriptions, which is, we need to have access to our journals. It's the same thing why we cannot choose freely where we want to publish. We have our journals where we have to publish in order to get a job. So most job descriptions say, well, you have to have published in certain high-ranking journals. And that journal hierarchy essentially prevents us from choosing where to publish. It's sort of like, if you want to become a professor, you have to have published in the equivalent of a Rolls-Royce, a Ferrari, and a Lamborghini. And if you don't, then you don't get a job. So, of course, Rolls-Royce, Ferrari, and Lamborghini, they can charge whatever the hell they want, because we can't really go anywhere else. So if we have a piece of research that these journals would find worth publishing, then of course we will pay that. So in as much as we can. So that would mean that, so there are several consequences of this. It would mean, for instance, Nature is on the record of charging in today's currency about 50,000 euros or dollars per article. So about 10 times the average price. And there's plenty of reasons for that, why that would be the case. So this is quite realistic, which means that only people who can pay $50,000 for their paper would be able to publish in these journals, which would add a level of inequality to an already quite unequal playing field in the current system. So things from that perspective would be worse. Now, one could think there's a strategy to negotiate national licenses, similar to the kind of what's called a big deal in subscription publishing, that you pay a flat rate per publisher. So let's say you take Springer Nature, for example, and you want to publish in Nature, and you're a member of a national consortium, and you have want to publish in Nature, and you don't pay 50,000 euros, but you pay 5,000. And this difference is being made up by paying also 5,000 for those journals that would usually cost only 500 to publish in. So that sort of flat rate publishing per publisher would, of course, have even more dire consequences to the libraries paying them as now. One can see that despite so many different ways of accessing paywalled content, libraries are very reluctant and have a very hard time canceling subscriptions. And that's just because of reading, when it just takes a few more clicks to read. So it's not a big inconvenience if your library would cut subscriptions now, and still they don't do it. Now imagine that you're in a national consortium, and the alternative, let's say we stick with Springer Nature, the alternative to your flat rate publishing is to have to publish 50,000, to have to pay 50,000 euros for a Nature paper. Clearly, this is more than an inconvenience. This is more than just a few extra clicks compared to your subscription deal. So clearly, when it was very difficult to get out of a subscription deal and put pressure on publishers, a big deal or flat rate publishing contract would be almost impossible to get out, because every single researcher or scientist in this country would cry and would march on the street demanding that this flat rate deal be upheld, because if they can't publish with the big journals, they can't get a job. So either way you turn it, if you want to have universal gold open access that's paid by author charges, author processing charges or APCs, things will look a lot worse than they are now.
Mm-hmm. So what would be your suggestion then? What would be the alternative to this scenario?
Now, we've discussed this for now more than 12 years, this situation that we're in. And I've never really had a good idea of how to solve it because of the circularity of the problem. There's many different players involved, librarians and faculty, publishers, funders, that all would have to do the same thing. It's a collective action problem. They have disparate roles and functions due to a lot of political reasons. They don't see themselves as cooperating partners anymore, but rather competing individuals. It's a chicken and egg problem. Who should start moving first? It's a problem of playing the blame game, like whose fault is it and who should do the next step. So there's a lot of issues that make this very, very difficult. For the first time a few years ago, we started, and that was coincided with the development of alternate ways to access paywalled content. We thought that, well, now would be a good time to just cut the subscriptions. Just let them run out. All those subscription deals that usually they run, you know, around 3 years, just don't renew them and use the money to buy modern technology to replace the legacy publishing business that's been running the way it is running now since the 17th century. The benefits of these things would be twofold, right? So for one, the publishers started buying important startup companies that were providing valuable services, digital services and digital tools for scholars. So without that money, they can't buy these things up anymore and put them behind their corporate proprietary paywalls. So that's one, you know, and much of it started with the acquisition of Mendeley by Elsevier, when we started realizing, oh, wait a minute, Elsevier is trying to buy components of our infrastructure. So that would be nice. We don't really need the subscriptions anymore, so we can cut them without much problem. And we prevent the publishers from invading our public infrastructure and making it private, sort of duplicating the privatization of a common good that we've seen in the journal articles, and to prevent publishers from expanding this to other areas of scholarly activities. And with that kind of money, $9 billion every year, you can buy a lot of modern technology that would just take care of all the issues that we're currently having with our data and with our code to make it accessible, such that reviewers can look at the code. If there's something in a table or in a figure, or something looks fishy, they can just look at the data and check if it's okay. And so here's the third argument of why cutting subscriptions is a good idea. With that sort of infrastructure, we will make it not impossible, but a lot more difficult than now to publish shoddy science that's either sloppy or fraudulent. And so we can have much more opportunity to screen and have more people look at questionable data and check if the data are reliable. The next benefit, the fourth benefit of cutting subscriptions, is that if we do it now, with many of the journals still relying on subscription income to survive, most journals would die. And because journal publishing is such an obstacle to having something changed at all, if the journals die, that obstacle would be gone. Like I said, the obstacle is there because we have to publish in certain journals to get a job, because it's required to have a certain number of articles in certain venues. If those venues don't exist anymore, that requirement can't be around. Now, So those are like four main reasons why it would be good to cut subscriptions now. Problem is, since we had that idea, several years have now passed, and publishers have expanded into several other scholarly activities already. And given the kind of profits that they make, just now Elsevier made in this year for the first time more than €1 billion in profit, they will have acquired enough components of our scholarly infrastructure to survive a cut in subscription. So we won't have too much time left to cut subscriptions. If we don't, in my personal estimate, if we don't cut subscriptions the next couple of years, 2-3 years maybe, then if we cut them later, probably it will be very difficult to implement the kind of infrastructure, the kind of open science infrastructure that we would like to have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you said that this would, that the whole problem that we brought ourselves in over the last decade, if not even longer, is you called it a collective action problem. So genuinely, you would think that everybody would have to take certain actions that are kind of orchestrated in order to repair, in air quotes, the whole system. That won't happen, right? You gave a couple of reasons why that is very unlikely to happen. The latest of which is probably something related to systems theory, that a system is always striving to keep itself alive. So on the publishers, on especially on the legacy publishers side, they would definitely fight for keeping up their revenues as high as possible, because that's what companies usually do. So what would be the initial spark, or where, maybe let's formulate it in a way, what's the level where we would need to set a certain spark in order to get things rolling?
Now, that's a question that is currently hotly debated. There's no consensus on this. There's plenty of ideas floating around. The usual fractures run around librarians and faculty. So the standard discussion that people have been having now for the last couple of years is, well, libraries should cut subscriptions, like I'm advocating. But libraries say, oh, no, but we can't cut subscriptions because people need to read. You, faculty, you have to just start publishing open access journals such that we can cut subscriptions, because nobody's reading those journals anymore, those non-open access, those paywalled journals anymore. And so this has been going on back and forth, where libraries say faculty should start and faculty say we can't. Libraries should start. My argument in this case towards librarians moving by letting subscriptions run out, my main argument is that we have, we are not free. We faculty are not free where to publish, as I said. Those faculty without tenure essentially have to publish in certain journals, and they don't really have a choice. If they, of course, I mean, in principle, in theory, they always have the choice to publish in a no-name open access journal and just not get a job at the end of the day. So that's always the risk. And even if it is explicitly mentioned in some cases, like in the REF in Great Britain, that journal rank and publishing venue does not count, this doesn't mean that it doesn't count anywhere. And of course, a Nature paper doesn't hurt. So the risk averse strategy of authors will always be to publish in the most highest ranking journal, because if you don't, it's a risk. But if you do publish there, it's never a risk. So clearly the most risk averse strategy is to publish in high ranking journals, which would mean that if you want to change faculty behavior, you would have, the UN lists about 7 million full-time equivalent researchers and scientists in the world, which probably amounts to anywhere between 10 and 15 million individuals, but 7 million full-time equivalents, you'd have to convince them to risk their job in order to change behavior. So that's, you know, if you think of a strategy, who should be convinced to do what, right? The strategy is always who should do what at what time. Now, if faculty should change, this would mean you'd have to convince 7 million full-time equivalents to risk their jobs. That's a tough call. That's going to take a while. That is theoretically possible, but I would say this will take a very, very long time. And you need to have very, very good arguments to say that. Mm. You know, you should risk your job for the greater good. It's very, I'm not sure there's many examples in the world where you can get 7 million people to risk their livelihoods for the greater good, not for their own benefit, but for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
So it's questionable whether this is even, you know, within 30 years, but whether this is even possible within one generation. It may take two or three generations.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yes.
And interestingly, you offer a lot of arguments why they should do this. I mean, not risk their jobs, but why there are good reasons not to go that path. I mean, you have you compiled a lot of indicators, at least, not even proofs, but you show in a lot of cases that the high-ranking journals, the glam journals, as they are sometimes called, that their quality is not as high as their reputation might indicate, right? You just published recently an interesting article regarding this that compiles a lot of this data that you collected before and presented already in your blog. But this is kind of scary, right? Isn't it that we are in an incentive system that is relying on such bad measurements and that seem to lead us in the complete wrong direction?
Right. So the incentives are so strong that even if you provide people with evidence that that articles published in high-ranking journals are no better than in any other journal, maybe even with a small effect, maybe even worse than those in other journals, it has zero effect. So if even such cold, hard data don't convince people to change their publishing or evaluation strategy, if that has zero effect, what else? If the scientific community cannot be convinced by data, what else could convince the most data-driven society or group of people on this planet? If data fails, what else can you use? So that's the argument why I'm saying it's going to be very difficult to convince 7 million people to change both evaluation strategies and publishing strategies if even hard data don't convince them to change anything. And so my argument then is, well, if this doesn't work, right, if not even data can change minds, and what other community other than the scientific community should be more easily convinced by data to change their minds than the scientific community? If that isn't even working, then maybe one should change strategies. And my recommendation is, and I look at the list of, for instance, the list of universities worldwide, it's about 10,000, and every one of those has a university library. So there's one library director there. Let's say there's another 10,000 non-university research institutions. So you have about 20,000, give or take a few thousand, university libraries. And let's say one or two people there, the leading people of that library, the directors and maybe the deputy director, or whatever the title is, they would need to be convinced to do their job, namely to provide the best infrastructure tax money can buy. And clearly, for just publishing articles, subscriptions isn't the best way. There's many, many good arguments why subscriptions are bad. So all you would have to do, instead of convincing 7 million full-time equivalents to change their strategy and risk their jobs, you would have to convince at most, let's say, 40,000 librarians and other infrastructure experts to do their job, namely to sit down and think, what's the best technological infrastructure that we can buy for the budget that we have for our faculty, the publishing needs of our faculty? And clearly, subscriptions, if they even come up at all, would be very, very far down on that list. So all you would need to do is convince people to do their job properly, the job of infrastructure experts, such as computing centers and libraries, is to provide us with an infrastructure that archives and makes accessible the fruits of our labor, which is in this day and age, which is our scientific code, our scientific data, and our scientific publications. So that should be served with the best current technical means. That is the job description of every librarian and every computing center employee on this planet. And that if they do that, then the only rational consequence can be is to cut most subscriptions, or at least those where we have alternate ways of accessing.
I mean, when we think about convincing libraries or librarians and using them, for example, as also as multipliers, taking actions themselves, but also kind of communicating why and the reasons behind their decisions into the system that they serve to, which are the academics, the researchers themselves, is kind of an approach that starts the spark in the middle of the system. What I'm always asking, and I would like to hear your stake on this, is why not start, or is it not a good approach to start a spark in the system that actually keeps the whole academia alive and that gives it the fundings, which is, as you already said a couple of times, the taxpayers, so the state. So would it be also a good idea to start at the policy level and trying to convince them with the arguments that the money that they give from the taxpayer to the scientific system should be invested in a way that the whole society gets the most out of it, right? You have to have a high return on investment, basically, and that the society is investing in science in order to progress. So
in the best of all worlds, it's absolutely possible, it's absolutely feasible, and it makes a lot of sense. However, also there are several hurdles that I think are more difficult to overcome than convincing librarians and other infrastructure experts to just do their job. For one, the policy is already there. It may not be explicit in every case, but the whole reason of existence of these infrastructure units is to do their job. The policy is provide the best service to your faculty. So you may have to do that more explicitly by saying, what is it? But in fact, what is the best infrastructure for your faculty changes every couple of years because the technology changes, and the people most competent to figure out what is the best service for our faculty are the ones that sit in libraries and computing centers, because those are the competent people that are trained in that sort of thing. So that's one aspect that is but the policy is already there. It just, you know, it changes with technology all the time. So you would have to upgrade the policy every, you know, 5 years or something. The other aspect is that if you want to access to politicians, you would need to access to high level politicians. This is a global problem. So in Europe, you would have to get access to EU level politicians, and in other places, supranational politicians at the UN, in as much as they can frame these sorts of things. And of course, then big, rich countries that can sort of form a nucleation point of changing things how they are run, like the US, Japan, outside of Europe, the US, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, and other leading, and China, of course, and other leading scientific nations. Now, I think everybody knows best what gives you access to that kind of high-level politicians. It's money. Now, compared to publicly funded universities, I would say that politicians, that publishers, especially legacy publishers with several hundred millions up to a billion in profit, will have much, much better access to these sorts of politicians than we have. And in Elsevier, for Elsevier in particular, they employ an army of what they call vice presidents for academic and government relations. And we all know what government relation means. It's lobbying. So publishers have seen the access to politicians as important and have been lobbying for decades. against our measures very, very effectively. The best, I think the best example besides all those employees, those full-time employees that do nothing all day long other than working against us and against the public interest, is the Research Works Act in the United States, when they paid Daryl Issa and Carolyn Maloney, a Republican and a Democrat respectively, in the US representatives, to draft a bill that would make green open access in the US illegal. That cost Elsevier about $40,000 to $50,000 to get access to these politicians and to have them draft the so-called this bill, the Research Works Act. And it took the open access community the better part of a year to stop that bill from getting anywhere. So a company that has €1 billion in profit every single year can essentially keep the open access movement, which is all amateurs essentially, busy a whole year with $40,000. So trying to get political access against that sort of lobbying power is probably going to be difficult. But then again, you might cut subscriptions and then you have $9 billion in lobbying power if you act collectively to get what done. Now that you already have the $9 billion, you don't need to have access to politicians anymore. So either you want to have access to politicians, then you need money. Where do you get the money from? Subscriptions. But if you have the money from subscriptions already, you don't need the politicians anymore. So I see this as, of course, this is a route. But if you have I'd like to hear a solution that can have that can outcompete full-time professional lobbyists from multi-billion-dollar corporations with a professor that knocks on the door of a politician and says, "Hey, do you have a minute for me?"
Yeah, I think that's the point where your argument or your approach regarding the librarians comes into play, right? If a single professor knocks on the doors, nobody will probably hear him or let him in. If several hundreds or thousand professors or librarians or whoever it is from inside the system knock on politicians' doors, they at least have to hear the arguments.
What should the libraries tell the politicians?
Yeah, basically the same that you would expect them to tell the academia when you use them as multipliers, right? That they need to build a system that makes it easy for their researchers to access any kind of literature that is currently hidden behind paywalls, even though they are not spending any more money on subscriptions, and at the same time building up some sort of infrastructure to not only share literature, but to share data, to share results of any kind, to make it easy for scientific results to become shareable, but also to become reproducible, checkable, whatever these arguments are, right?
But that would sound great. If I'm a politician in Berlin, let's say, right? I'm a national politician. Yeah. I'm the Ministry for Research and Education, for instance. I would say, oh, this is fantastic. This is really great. I love what you're doing. What state are you from? Oh, Bavaria. That's right. Of course, the universities in Bavaria are under Bavarian jurisdiction, not mine. Why don't you go to the minister in Bavaria and tell them to do that? And your universities, you have autonomy, right? We granted you autonomy several years ago. So why don't you just go ahead and do it? What do you think librarians will answer when they are told, why don't you just go ahead and do it? You have autonomy.
I see the argument. The kind of educational freedom or scientific freedom is an argument that I have not on the highest rank on my paper, to be honest. But what prevents companies that spend thousands, if not hundred thousands, or even million of dollars into lobbying at the policy level, what does prevent them from kind of lobbying on the librarians' level?
They do it. Why do you think they get? In total, I think I read it today, a 25% price increase in the last 4 years. How do you think they do that? Do they do that by saying, pretty please give me a 6% raise this year? No. They send professional negotiators that are the best that money can buy on the planet, that are psychologically trained, and send them to argue in a very, very professional way with a librarian whose job certainly is not to negotiate subscriptions, and if it is, then only to a small extent, who's not even nearly as highly trained or as experienced in these negotiations as those professional negotiators. So nothing else than, you know, lobbyism, then, you know, okay, that's why they call it. That's why the same person is government relations, vice president for academic and government relations. In Germany, this is, for instance, for Elsevier, this is a lady called Angelika Lex. Her full-time job is A, to get as much money as possible out of librarians, and B, to interfere with anything politicians could possibly do to stop that revenue stream. That's her full-time job, and she has plenty of employees that she can delegate small jobs to. Hmm.
Whenever I think about professional negotiators going to librarians, I always think about, hey, I have an offer you can't deny. It really sounds like mafia, and I fear it's not very far away from it, right? The question that I'm really thinking about is if your approach is kind of a quick win to at least start and go to librarians and start convincing them, what are, besides the arguments that we have and that are more and more becoming backed up by data, that we can actually prove the arguments that subscriptions is not the best way, that the quality in higher ranked journals is not always, if not, well, hardly the better quality, and we'll come to that later. What arguments do we have against those people that sit at the same table just an hour later and negotiating with the librarians to leave subscriptions as they are, because they even get more services, they even get more access to wider ranges of publications? So in short, why should librarians listen to us instead of listen to Elsevier?
That's a good question. In the end, we can only hope that scholarly arguments make the day. Mm. If it comes to that, I've never heard that. Not even behind closed doors and off the record. I've never heard that. But if publishers would go to the extreme negotiating tactic of over coffee asking one of the librarians, hey, I've heard you have a mortgage, how about me helping you a little bit with that? Mm. Against corruption, there's nothing you can do. So you can only hope, and I think at least in Germany, we have a decent, looking at the corruption index, we have a decent chance, and I have the greatest faith I can have in my colleagues in the library. I see them as colleagues, I see them as cooperating partners, and a reform like this can only work if you base it in trust. Yeah. I trust librarians. I trust the computing center people. I trust them that they work in our interest and that they've chosen the job because they want to work for scholarship. They want to support scholarship. And if this is the main goal, then our arguments, as you say, as they are backed up by data, they should be convincing.
Yeah. And I mean,
if they are not, I don't know what we should do.
Yeah. And I mean, many of them are scientists themselves. And I mean, with bibliometrics, we have kind of a data-based metrics coming from librarians and from the library systems, even though that is part of the problem that brought us here, because it's a bit flawed in itself. The good thing is that we already see a number of libraries and a number of library communities or where you have a number of different libraries cooperating together as basically one bigger library. A number of them have already started going into this direction by either canceling subscriptions, at least putting more pressure on negotiations by sending out signals and signs that this is something that they won't take up longer. And for example, we have a number of libraries, and that number is constantly ever growing, that offer services that definitely make it easier for the academics that they serve to publish open access in repositories, in maybe even support them in publishing in open access journals that are not as high ranked as Nature, etc., by providing services to them to help them process data, collect data, store data, and all these kind of activities. So there is definitely a silver lining at the horizon, right?
I think so too. That more and more the idea is coming, and I think this is there are several factors playing into this. For one, there's more and more digital competence in the libraries.
Yeah.
Another thing is that for a long time now, librarians have been, of course, equally as, you know, as if librarians strive to serve scholarship, they see that what they're forced to do, stuck between a rock and a hard place, as you can say, between publishers and faculty, that's not how a library should work. A lot of people have wondered what the future of the library might bring, what it might look like. If there will be libraries in the future, if they as brokers between publishers and faculty may disappear at some point. And I think the idea that librarians are at the heart of the scholarly infrastructure of the world and of each institution, this is a tremendous, in my opinion, a tremendous correction of the position that the library plays in the scholarly ecosystem. Right now, they're sort of relegated to the sidelines, when I think they should be front and center of the way we do scholarship. It's like, this is where our most coveted, where the most important things go and are archived and made accessible and reusable and findable, such that the public that pays the research enterprise gets the most out of it. And so I hope that this central position of the library in scholarship is a very attractive model and a very attractive utopia, if you wish, that motivates people to work towards that utopia and to be open to the arguments that we have.
So that on the long run, not the libraries disappear, but hopefully the commercial legacy publishers disappear.
Exactly. And what we can have instead, of course, we don't need, I personally don't care who does what, as long as it's done competently and at a reasonable price. And the way to ensure that things get done competently and at a reasonable price is if you have, and the reasonable price guarantee comes with competition. And so the analogy in how to get there is that scholarship should become, or the digital infra, our digital infrastructure should become a regular part of the infrastructure, just as our analog infrastructure, just as electricity, water, gas, ventilation, heating, these sorts of things. We have, every university has technical expertise inside. If there's something not working, or if something has to be replaced, or something has to be upgraded, they look at the system and they say, okay, no, we can do it ourselves, or no, we need an outside company. And if it's big enough, you have a bidding process, which company will the responsible bidder will do the job. And the same thing we could do with our digital infrastructure for publications, data, and code is by saying, okay, we have certain standards, like we have a 50 hertz 220 volts standard in Europe, 110 60 hertz in other places. So you have certain standards. If you operate around those standards, you can pick any supplier. It doesn't matter to which electrician I go to fix my electricity. It doesn't matter which plumber fixes my pipes as long as I have certain standard pipes that he also has and can connect to. So the same is true, of course, for our digital infrastructure, such that at some point we will have, we should have, that would be an analogous development. We should have certain standards in our infrastructure, and as long as you adhere to those standards, it doesn't matter which service provider you use. And if all service providers become too expensive because it's an open standard, we can easily just acquire the knowledge and the competence to do it ourselves if we think that doing it ourselves becomes cheaper. So we can always exert a downward pressure on price by having competence in-house. And so if we want to get there, then this cutting subscriptions would be the quickest way, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
Now that you actually talked about competence and kind of standards and inherently also about quality, maybe that's a good opportunity to segue into this often discussed and often highly argumented term of quality within the scientific system. And I guess when we look into the future of digital academic publishing, quality plays a role on two basic levels. One is in, as I would call it in air quotes, on an external level, which means that you should be able to provide some kind of, let's call it, platform that is built up according to a certain standard of quality, offering the services that are needed by the researchers to publish on this platform, but also by the demands or the needs of those who are actually consuming what is offered by the platform, be it articles, be it data, whatever this is. So the functionality and the services offered should be of a certain quality. But then we also have an interior quality that should hold up when you look at the individual output, the article, the data set. This should be of a high quality. And you lately published an article, I guess, on Frontiers that exactly deals with this kind of inner quality, where you took a look at the level of retractions that are done by a number of journals, and whether you can find or understand any kind of pattern that could be drawn from the data that shows whether there are more or less retractions on classical high impact factor journals as opposed to more modern, for example, open access journals, right?
So actually, I looked at the opposite.
Ah, nice.
to be honest, so I looked at those that are not retracted, because
all right,
the retracted articles are just 0.05% roughly of the literature. It's a little less than 0.05 even. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very little. So it's a very skewed percentage. And the problem with retractions, besides it, so the other problem with the retractions, besides it not being representative because it's such a small number of articles, the other problem is that you don't know how much error detection plays in. So you can always make the case that if higher ranking journals have higher retraction rates, it's because they're better at detecting problems. Mm-hmm. Right? So that a high retraction rate is actually a good thing. Right? Because you can say that, you know, 5% of all research is wrong. And the closer do you get to those, simply for statistical reasons, that's, you know, it's a shortened argument. It's probably not statistically valid, but that's it's an easy shorthand for now. If 5% of all research is wrong, then those journals that get closest to those 5% are the best, mm-hmm, because they find the mistakes. Mm-hmm. Right? So in that case, you can say that retraction rate is actually a quality indicator.
But that's only to the amount of kind of acceptance of the argument that all research can be false at a given point in time, right? Because what we found 10 years ago might turn out to be falsified now that we have better methods of analysis, better understanding of the subject, progressed kind of knowledge. So that is, I guess, an argument that is not very widely openly discussed.
That is true, but I think that it's probably not discussed that much because it's quite clear that these things change and that we find out that certain things that we thought we knew do not hold up with new measurements or more precise measurements. Like you say that, you know, this measurement is equal to this measurement, and then if you measure more precisely, you find out, oh, no, it's the measurement was okay at the time, but if you measure more precisely, you find that there actually is a difference. It's just smaller than the measuring device could detect. Mm-hmm. So these sorts of things are fine because what we're talking about, what a lot of people are discussing today is actually the problem that if you use the same measuring device in a different lab with the same object of measurement, you do not find the same result. Now, and that, I think, if that ever happens, that is a major problem. And that is, in the biological and psychological sciences, is itself, even if you do everything perfectly, is a major problem. And it's not quite clear how to solve it. I remember long before anybody talked about things like a replication crisis or anything, there was, I think it was about around 2000, there was an article in Science on fickle mice. That was part of the title of the article. And what people have done, they have taken a pair of transgenic mice that generated offspring that had certain alterations in the brain. And then they generated a lot of these offspring and transported the mice, all siblings, brothers and sisters, to different labs in the world to do exactly the same experiments, roughly at the same time, so at the same time of day, which of course doesn't work at the same time for time shift reasons. And it turned out that the results were surprisingly variable, meaning that small differences in the protocol, small differences in the people who treat the animals, small differences in the kind of details how the experiments were set up had huge effects on the outcomes of the experiments. And that, of course, is a major problem that is technically solvable. Namely, if as much of the way the experiments were done is accessible. So if you use videos to record your experiment, if you show this is how I do it, if you produce, if you let the digital data get accessible, like this is how I evaluate it, look at the raw data, maybe the raw data are different. Is it the evaluation script or is it the raw data that look different? And so on and so on. So this kind of inherent difficulty in some experimental sciences is solvable with the kind of infrastructure that we're talking about. There is another problem, though, in that the incentives, for instance, not only to where to publish, but also how much to publish, provide incentives that exacerbate those difficulties. So if you do everything right, if you do everything as good as you can, if you repeat your measurement many, many times to exclude a big effect of any outlying measurements that you have, if you have a lot of variability, you just have to measure many, many times to get rid of this. But many times means you can't have many, many publications. And if you can't have many, many publications, you can't have a job. So it all boils back down to this, is that we need to provide an infrastructure that removes incentives to cut corners and to rely on outliers. Outliers often being, oh, who would have thought that this effect is so big? We should send it to Nature because nobody would have thought this is really of general interest. Nobody would have thought there's such a big effect. And then, of course, if you do it with many, many replications, you find that the effect is much, much smaller, if it's even there at all. So both in terms of quantity and in terms of publishing venue, we should have an infrastructure that removes any incentive to cut corners, because even if you do it perfectly, it's already difficult enough. So we really should incentivize, and actually, no, let me take that back. No, what we really should do, we should try to provide an infrastructure that removes incentives to cut corners. I am naive enough to believe that every scientist is a scientist because they want to find something new. They want to find out how something works. They want to make discoveries. Nobody sets out, I hope, to become a Nobel laureate or to attain a certain level of fame or to make a certain amount of money. I would at least hope that it's a very, very small minority, if there's anybody at all. So I would think that just by removing counterproductive incentives, everybody should be self-interested in their own research topic enough to try to do the science as good as they possibly can. So that's, I think, one of the most important aspects of our current infrastructure, is that it should just be an enabling infrastructure that lets us do the job the way we want it to do. And I think this is more important than access, because access itself to anything cannot be a goal. The goal must be to do science as good as we can. And then to have access to it is just a means to an end. So access is not the end. Access is a means to an end. So if we think about what is the end, what should science look like, then we can think of the kind of infrastructure that we need for that. And then access is an automatic given, because we need it to do science properly.
Mm. Yeah, this is what we're always saying in a way, right? In principle, we don't want open science, we want just science. And this is basically the path there, right? Good scientific practice and removing this kind of hurdles and making it as easy as possible to do proper science, and not due to limitations of whatever, of the page sizes, removing a piece of information, or due to the limit of supplemental material, not putting stuff there. All these kind of things are hampering actually good science, and additionally also bring wrong incentives, as discussed before. And I mean, in your publication that we just discussed, there are many other things besides retraction rate. You also talked about, for example, error rate in genomics, and also statistical power, and so on. So all these kind of things are not much better in these high-ranking journals, and it should be basically increase the general level of these kind of things. And this infrastructure that we're talking about could be here the key element of this, bringing this general level to a higher value, actually.
Right, exactly. So just remove incentives. I mean, the whole idea of needing incentives is already, I find, rather reprehensible. If I would, you know, it assumes that without incentives, I would just slack off and do nothing. So I don't think we need to provide incentives for people to do good science. What we need to do is we need to get rid of all the things that prevent them from doing good science, and things will get quite well. Now, I'm very willing to discuss with pessimistic people. I'm an optimist in this, or you may call me naive in thinking that most people want to do good science. A pessimist might argue, well, they can't do good science because they're not well-trained enough. They don't have, they're not self-interested enough. They have all kinds of reasons why they're not going to do the best science that they can. If there's data to support that claim, I'm willing to concede that I've been too naive and too optimistic, and that we may need to implement also incentives towards doing good science. But as it stands now, I'm convinced that I'm an average scientist, and I try to do my science as good as I can. So I fear that most people are like me and will try to do the best science that they possibly can. And if that is too naive, I'm willing to be convinced if there is some data to convince me otherwise.
Mm. I think there's also kind of a diversity and a certain distribution, but I'm also a strong believer in intrinsic motivation, especially in sciences. This is, I guess, one of the driving forces, and we're definitely not here because of the good money and the fame that we get. But Yeah, but yeah, you have to really love what you're doing. And I think this is, again, if you have this tool at hand that makes you do this much better, I think everybody would benefit, and especially society, as they get the output of this research in different means then. So, Björn, what do you think? So we started roughly with a, let's say, the rather pessimistic view on this, but we saw there can be better paths of implementing all this. What would be your suggestion for every individual maybe listening to this, being a scientist, being working in a library, and basically everybody who might listen here? What would be your suggestions to them? What can they do to drive to a system that we discussed?
Talk to your librarian today. Tell them that you can get access to anything you want to read. You're fine with if your library cancels all the subscriptions and keeps the money to implement stuff that benefits, that implements technology that benefits each faculty member. Talk to them today. Call them up. Send them an email and say, look, if you ever considered cutting subscriptions or not renewing your big deal with the big publishers, go ahead and do it. I'm going to be fine. My colleagues are also going to be fine, even those that don't talk to you. Cut the subscriptions, but keep the money and build something meaningful and something helpful for our scientific infrastructure out of that saved money.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm the only one, but I have a feeling that there's a big elephant in the room that we haven't yet described well enough, because we talked about a lot of points circulating around one central aspect and one central term that we mentioned over and over, which is infrastructure. What is the infrastructure that you would put in a vision of a system that you would like to have working inside the academic world?
Oh, yeah, that's quite easy. And this is something that this is probably the most easy part. When you talk to people who sit on the computer all day and who use digital tools, it only takes about 5 minutes to all agree on, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that we want to have. And of course, we want this too, and this too, and this too. So the kind of shopping basket is pretty easily agreed upon, and it grows as you talk about it. When you say, oh yeah, wouldn't it be cool to have this, and wouldn't it, yeah, right? So these sorts of things are quite easy. Mm-hmm. Now we can start with publications. The way I would like to publish is very simple. I would like to write a paper together with my colleagues. So I need a collaborative authoring environment. Ideally, they would just log in with something like their EduRome account, which means they don't need to have a special account for it. And if that EduRome account is linked to their personal data, all their affiliation and everything would be included automatically. And so I write the paper with them. Because I'm writing it, now I'm going towards figures and that sort of thing, because our data is automatically taken care of. I save it somewhere on my hard drive, which is automatically mirrored to a server that I can use. That serves both as backup and as accessible server. I can simply say, in this part of the text, I want to have this code, I want to have this data displayed with this piece of code. And because my code is also taken care of in, let's say, a similar version controlled tool, such as we are now using GitHub, but now this would be an institutional tool. All I have to do is I say, okay, call this code, and process this data, and then I would have the figure right there, and I would only have to write the legend for it. And or if it's a microscopy figure, I would just say I want to use this figure, and the figure would be right there because I already have it and it's online. And once we all say, okay, now this looks good, our undergrads have read it, our grandmothers have read it, and whatever, to provide us with feedback on language and typos and stuff like that, then we just hit submit and it's published. We don't have to shop around for journals or anything like that. One click and it's public. And then that's from an author perspective, and that I'm fine with that. Now, in that sort of way, one can start making a decision how much of the literature that we're producing like this actually needs peer review. right? I mean, we all look at non-peer-reviewed literature, A, as reviewers, or B, for instance, when we look at the work of our colleagues, either informally or at meetings. So this is all not peer-reviewed. So clearly, there is a big market for non-peer-reviewed literature because we consume it all the time. And so one can make an argument that not every, and this could be determined by authors or by academic editors or whatever, whatever instance we want to, whether or not a particular article actually needs peer review, or whether it should just be published for those peers who are interested in it. Because if it's written for peers, why would peers need peer review? That doesn't make any sense, right? Peer review is there to make, you know, make a validity statement. But if I'm a peer, I don't need somebody else to tell me if this is valid, because I can, by reading it, I can tell you if that is valid. And if I have recommender system that someone says, oh, I've read this, is really cool, I don't need peer review either. If I want to have peer review as a flag that I should be reading something, I can have better ways of doing this rather than forcing people to read something they may not even want to read. So I've looked at my own papers, and less than half I would send out for peer review. Less than half, I say, okay, this is something that people outside of my field should also read. More than half is essentially from a fly guy like me to other fly guys. And I don't see any reason why it should be peer-reviewed. If I had a choice, so to say, if this would be up to me, less than half would get peer-reviewed. And maybe other people think in a similar way. And that would reduce the peer-review burden quite a bit and maybe make the peer-review that does happen more thorough. And people would be able to put more time into the much fewer peer reviews that they are doing. And then as a reader, of course, I want to have a system that provides me every morning when I open my computer with a newspaper-like page and tells me this is the most relevant stuff that you should be looking at today. And with current tools, this is easy to do. I use some of them for some part of my literature. But it's nowhere near as efficient as it could be if we had just one place where all the literature is and conforming, fully accessible in full text, and conforming to a common standard such that tools can just be implemented on top of that, plugins, for instance, on that. And then I would have a tool, a recommender tool, that would tell me what is relevant for me, would maybe give me a random choice of things that I wouldn't have found with a recommender tool, and that learns from what the things are that I click on to find the kind of stuff that is relevant for the kind of work that I do. As a reader, as a peer reviewer, of course, I would have a peer review plugin on top of this multi-user authoring system, such that I can communicate anonymously if it has to be. I can communicate with the authors while we're all together editing the manuscript and reviewing the manuscript, so I can make comments on the manuscript and say, here, this is what you should change, this is what you might want to change. And then the authors can accept or not accept. And I can, for instance, find out which is the reviewer that has the most accepted suggestions on manuscripts, or that sort of silly thing, right? So this is something that I would like to have. And this would be very convenient, would save a lot of time. And I could really, this would enable me to focus on my experiments, how to communicate the experiments, and on the intellectual exchange with my colleagues.
Mm. And I didn't hear anything that seems to be not possible. I mean, and not even on we're not even talking about technology, because we have all the technology that we would need in order to establish it, even with more sophisticated means of recommendation that are not based on some kind of taxonomy that is abstracted from the content. It could be just be recommendations based directly on the content, because we have algorithms in order to kind of look through and process text and data and come up with some kind of pre-analysis in order to be recommended to somebody who is doing the same stuff or working in the same field or citing the same sources or whatever it is. So there isn't a problem about tech, or there is no technological problem. There isn't even a processual problem as I see it, because nothing that you mentioned seems to be odd. The only thing that is probably most debatable about your arguments that you just mentioned, and there are probably others, is the peer review thing, right? Because peer review is something that sparks very opposing opinions oftentimes. But even there is a simple solution. Either you can trigger peer review by yourself by judging, hey, this should be an article that is probably going wider than my own scientific community working on the same stuff. So this could be peer reviewed or should be peer reviewed in order to give it more weight and more show higher validity so that others coming from different academic backgrounds, but also coming from non-academic backgrounds, as is often the case with me, I want to have some kind of sign that this is at least reasonably and methodology wise well conducted research that I can rely on if I base some kind of argument on it, right? But that could be either triggered by the authors themselves if they have the feeling, or maybe that could be challenged by the community. Maybe if you have 200 votes saying, hey, this should be peer reviewed, somebody as an expert should look on it, whether this is really interpretable in the way that the authors did. So I don't see a problem there. And
exactly. That is perfectly easy to do.
Yeah. The only problem that we have is that this currently comes from a lot of places, and that we have to either unite them. So usually many of these features are currently built in community projects, right? Often open source and non-precary community projects. So we either have to bring them together and put them on a more stable basis, maybe even give them funding to concentrate on working on these kind of aspects. Or, as I always say, it could be easily done by somebody even in the legacy publishers world who has enough money on the side. Imagine what Elsevier could establish in an instance by just the power that they have and the money that they have if they wouldn't be who they are. Right?
Well, I mean, in a way, this is what they're doing. They're buying these solutions, and they're buying them at a large scale. So they've now bought B2B Press last year, which is a large institutional repository software. They bought Mendeley, and so they bought a whole. If you look at if you search for Elsevier acquisitions, yeah. You will see what kind of stuff they've bought. They buy these sorts of things, and the possibility is, though, because they're so powerful, is that they're going to become a monopoly, such that they will, of course, try to generate vendor lock-in, such that once a university has committed to buy all their open science tools from Elsevier, they can't buy the offer from anybody else. And so Elsevier then, again, is free to charge as much as they want because you can't go to somebody else, and you have a monopoly power. And this is what Elsevier is going for right now. And if we don't cut subscriptions pretty damn soon, this is what sits on the horizon and is looming there and saying that, okay, well, we're going from one vendor lock-in, which is publishers, to another vendor lock-in, which is open science providers. And this is why the easiest thing, again, is to use the money ourselves. Right now, what we're doing is we give the money to Elsevier, and then we hope that Elsevier will be will change 180 degrees and all of a sudden become a nice guy and become derelict of their fiduciary duty, right? Elsevier is a publicly traded company, which means that if they ever can show that their board of directors is not maximizing profit, they can get fired, right? So they must maximize profit or be fired. The best way to maximize profit is in a monopoly, because then you can charge what you want. So essentially, by hoping that Elsevier solves the problem for us, we're also hoping that the board acts against the fiduciary duty that they're bound to. I don't find that very likely. I don't think that's going to happen. That they're going to say that the board of directors is going to say, okay, all right, we're a publicly traded company. and I get 300 million in bonuses every year, I'm going to just drop all this and say, we'll help the scholarly community, we'll violate all the rules by which we've been bound, and we'll become good guys. The chances that that's going to happen are essentially zero. So again, what we should do is we should spend the money ourselves, not give the money to Elsevier and hope that they, in some unrealistic way, they're going to violate all the rules that they're bound to, but use the money and buy these things ourselves. And then I would say, from what you, and I would agree with you, that technically this is not a problem. Yeah. Now, if you say, let's say we will, you know, we have decided in January to drop all subscriptions for 2018. If that were possible, it's not even possible, right? But hypothetically speaking, it would mean that we would have $9 billion to create that infrastructure. I would make the case with that kind of money, it would take 6 months before we have it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, which holds its own problem in itself, because most of the time we have just a lot to do when it comes to developing something, be it algorithms, be it tools, that is needed in individual experiments or in individual science strengths. And we're currently seeing over the last maybe two, three, maybe even longer years, we're seeing more and more the community uprise of the scientific software engineers who are more or less responsible in order to building tools from inside the academic system or the scientific system. However, they could probably, or it probably becomes a hard task if we also have to develop all the tools that we need for the infrastructure on a broader level ourselves. So the question is, who do we rely upon doing this? Is it still the community projects, which is fine, then we should give them a bit more funding? Is it companies, calling them startups, looking into developing a certain aspect, a certain services inside a wishful infrastructure for the academic world in the future, which is also fine. But then we should think about what kind of incentives do we give them in order to not sell to somebody like Elsevier and thereby kind of increasing the chances of building monopolies, but rather selling it to the public. Because these companies, startups, are there to exist, or at least to exit, right? And it's a totally understandable motivation.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. No, so, but the key to all of this is to have an open standard that is modular, right? But in the most general terms of modular, right, you could think of, such that you can replace anything, any functionality with a different functionality. Mm-hmm. As long as the standards are adhered.
Right.
You know, it's very similar. As long as it's HTML, it doesn't matter whether you want to display a video or an audio or text,
right,
or a figure. As long as it's HTTP, it doesn't matter what goes through HTTP. As long as the browser can handle HTML, it doesn't matter whether you use Opera, Firefox, or Safari, or Internet Explorer, whatever, mm-hmm, or Edge. It doesn't matter. So it's replaceable. So as long as you have that, you can sell whatever you want to Elsevier, as long as you can replace. If Elsevier charges too much, you can replace it with something else.
Right.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm saying we need to buy this, get it under our control, use the money to establish the standards, get the first set of tools running, such that then if a community tool is being built, a company wants to say, hey, this is really cool, we can compete on this, we can do it better and charge money for it. Go ahead, do it better and charge money for it. That's fine. People then have the choice in how they want to do that. And this empowers universities and enables open scholarship.
Which kind of brings us back to the policy level in the far end, because we need to, as much as we need to convince librarians to take action and to convince scientists to take action and start developing this stuff, they also are dependent on funding. So we need to convince on the policy level to also give funding to those initiatives and to those projects that look into developing open standards, that look into uniting communities and bringing those standards that are existent to the table in order to come up with something that can be used by everybody in a reliable way, and that we can use to build a broad infrastructure upon without being tied to any kind of publisher offering this as a commercial service.
Absolutely. And the only thing where maybe, and that depends very much on countries. So in Germany, we don't need it that much. In other countries, we definitely would need policy or political support, mm-hmm. is that if we cut subscriptions, that this money doesn't go somewhere else, that it stays with the libraries. I talked to librarians in Germany and they say, we are pretty much sovereign of our budget. If we decide to put it into something more valuable, then we can do that. In other countries like Great Britain and the US, it's not that clear. It may be that if they cut subscriptions, the money just flows back to the university and they can spend it on the salary of the vice chancellor or something like that. So this is maybe where in some countries political support would be very helpful in making sure that any funds, any infrastructure funds that go towards subscriptions now that need to be changed into actual infrastructure funds, that they don't go away, that they stay where they are, such that that kind of money would go towards a librarian organized budget for infrastructure development.
Mm-hmm. So, and for this, libraries have to kind of unite and ask for this together, right? I mean, I'm not sure what the status is regarding this. If they form already a kind of a common voice in order to ask explicitly for that.
So librarians, of course, already work together in consortia. So in the 90s, those big deals were negotiated in many cases with regional, in some cases national, in other cases even supranational consortia. So there's the DACH consortium, for instance, for German-speaking countries, that is a supranational consortium for certain big deal subscriptions. Now there's the DEAL consortium in Germany, there's certain regional consortia in the US. The consortia are not that large in the US compared to other places in the world. So librarians in principle are used to, for more than 20 years, are used to cooperating between libraries. We've had interlibrary loan for decades. So at least in principle, now then in practice it may look different, but at least in principle librarians are very cooperative and are very used to cooperating with each other across institutions.
Right. So can we think of something that leaves us with a good message in the end of this episode? I mean, we've come from pointing out the flaws of the current system, going to where we could start a change, talking about different aspects of why this change is so difficult and what needs to be changed, being from political influence to institutional influence to something like quality indices and all these kind of things, to the point where we have to describe some kind of vision for an infrastructure that would, from the momentary standpoint, be a well-being infrastructure for academic workings, not only publishing.
I think the good message is that librarians are competent. They are experts in what they do. They're motivated. They have, for centuries, they have been the ones that curate, archive, and make accessible scholarly works. They have the historical and, I would hope, also political support to provide us with the best possible infrastructure. And they have the expertise and competence. I think that is definitely a good message. And they also have, by and large, they have the motivation to do so. I think what holds librarians back from being the kind of innovative core that we would hope to be, to help the faculty out that are stuck in their old ways and that can't get out for a risk of their livelihoods, is that if those faculty members that care enough would encourage librarians and support librarians and saying, look, you're the experts. I don't know how things are working, but I know the way it is now is not sustainable. The way it is now is bad for science. You got to do your thing. Try to get us the best possible infrastructure that we can get. We support you. I think, but the only thing that's missing, I would say, is the kind of support that would then embolden and encourage librarians to act on their expertise. Most librarians I talk to know precisely what they're doing. They know the solutions. They know what should be done. They hate negotiating subscriptions. They feel marginalized. If the psychological spark would come from faculty supporting librarians and saying, look, act on your expertise. Do what you know is good for us. That spark would set off, could set off a revolution.
Yeah. And luckily, as we already said, there are some very good examples of libraries taking actions definitely in the right direction. And maybe this is not well known to our international audience, as we mention one of those examples a lot in the German episodes, which is the Leibniz Information Center for Science and Technology, which is a university library in Hanover. This is, for me at least, one of the good examples in Germany of a library taking action into the right direction, because they have not only set up a team that is well aware of what a modern library should offer as services, but they have also established something that is called Open Science Lab, where they use the innermost method of science that can be used, which is the experiment. They just start experimenting to come up with services that might be of use and that might be open to other institutions, to other individuals, to be used not only by those being member of the university in Hanover. So if you're interested in having a good example, and there are probably a lot of examples also on the international level, take a look at what the TIB is doing. It's really incredible.
Yes, I can only second that. I was one of the evaluators of the TIB a couple of weeks ago, and I could see the inner workings of the library, of that institute, with their new director, Søren Auer, and it was fantastic. And all the evaluators were very impressed and very positive. Yeah. And that's probably more than I should have said already publicly. I can only second the fantastic example that this institution is setting, yeah, definitely on the national and also on the international level.
And they are constantly working towards getting more funds for their projects. And it seems to me, as an external site, that the work that they are doing becomes more and more welcomed by the institutional funders, being the BMBF in Germany or DFG in Germany. You see more and more funds being distributed to those actors, as the TIB is one. So that's a very good and very positive direction that we're striving into.
Great. Yeah, I guess we are at the end of it. And Björn, we have to thank you so much for this. This was really amazing. I think it's a good to-do list for many people listening here. So librarians and scientists, please talk to each other. I think we have a kind of a roadmap already. No, it's maybe a little bit too much, but at least a to-do list, what needs to be done. And I'm still very positive that we, in principle, can change the system in this, let's say, in the direction of this nice utopian way, and clearly with some trade-offs. But I think we have a clear vision, a clear aim where it should go to. And from this, I can just thanks a lot, Björn, and it was a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Right.
Okay.
I guess we're at the end. As always, if you have questions, if you have comments, put them into the comments under this episode. And I guess from here we have basically a very good starting point to also get a couple of guests from the librarian world, because this seems to be a very interesting world to look at right now, playing potentially such an important role and in determining what ways to go, but also playing an important role as being one of the fundamental service providers in the academia world. So we'll definitely we'll do that. And for so long, thanks for listening, Björn. Thanks for being on, and see you around.
Bye.
Bye.